Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. The 2020 presidential election has come and gone, and no matter who you voted for, the process and suspense has been killer, with it taking almost 4 days for there to be a clear winner, and even longer to verify the results and count all the votes. Here at RCP, we sought to bottle the feelings that we all experienced on election night and preserve them here in the RCP 2020 Election Special episode. In this extra special episode of Real College Podcast, we take a look behind the scenes at how polling actually works, take ourselves back to November 3rd with a little bit of comedic relief, a dive into political advertising, and an extra special installment of Radio K Sports Hour. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. In our first segment of the 2020 election special episode, we will go behind the scenes with reporter Isaac Maruyama and find out how political polling actually works. Here's Isaac with more.
How do polls really work? What does it mean when a candidate is predicted to win an election? And why do we sometimes wind up with unexpected results? I'm sure I'm not the only one who's had these questions on their mind over the past few weeks. Luckily, I know the perfect person to ask all of these questions. My honors mentor, Tim White, runs his own election forecast. You can check out Tim's forecast for the 2020 election at plusminusforecast.com. I'm hoping to learn from his actual experience with polls and predictions and figure out how they should influence the way we think about elections. I'll let Tim take it from here.
So I'm Tim. I'm a student at the U, third year studying statistics and economics. Plus Minus Forecast is a website I started this summer, and it houses a statistical model I built to forecast the outcome of the presidential election, just the general election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Basically, it uses historical data and polling data from this year as inputs and tries to quantify like the uncertainty and how confident we can be about prescribing an outcome to the election. It started off pretty far in advance, so it was less confident, and then it grew in confidence as we approached election day.
So how did you go about selecting which polling data to include? Like, was there a process for deciding which things to, you know, take out or value more highly than others?
Yeah, so one way, basically a good starting point is if you look back at past elections, if a state votes a couple points more Republican or more Democrat relative to the popular vote, the national popular vote in an election, then your best guess is probably for the next election, it's gonna do the same thing. So for example, in 2016, Clinton won the popular vote by about 2 points nationally, lost the Electoral College, but won the popular vote by 2 points. And Trump won Michigan by basically, it was quite close. It was like 1/5 of a percentage point. So Michigan was about 2 points more Republican than the country. And this year it looks like it's gonna be a similar result. Biden's probably gonna win the popular vote by 4 or 5 points, and Michigan's gonna go to Biden by 2 or 3 points. So that 2 point gap is still intact. So that's one way I looked at the 2016 and 2012 elections and figured out how far to the left or right relative to the country the state leaned in terms of the two major parties, and then kind of applied that to this year as like my starting point. Then probably the primary input data is polling. So a lot of firms, whether like they're all nonpartisan for the most part. We use internal partisan polls to some extent, but they're not weighted very heavily. But like universities and independent organizations and sponsored by media organizations will sponsor polls. And some are higher quality than others. So we include the model includes every poll, but ones that we know to be higher quality historically that sample more people or that sample a population that's more likely to vote in the election are weighted more heavily in the average. So we pool those together, and then that creates another set of projections in addition to the like past elections data projection in each state. Those two factors are two of the three that go into the polling average. Another one is this was more applicable early in the summer when we didn't have as much polling data because polling starts to ramp up as we near the election. But say, for example, we know that, let's say, Mississippi and Alabama are similar demographically. Mm-hmm. And say we didn't have polling in Mississippi, but we did in Alabama, then the model will also not use an Alabama poll in Mississippi to some extent to fill in the gap where we don't have polling. Okay. So that's a factor that kind of fades out as we near the election and get more like state specific data. But that's one way to like fill in gaps early on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just mentioned that sometimes there could be a disconnect between, you know, the selection of people that are being polled and the selection of people that might actually turn out and vote in the election. Do you have any idea, just based off of the information that you're using, what is the tendency for that difference between polling and actual election results, if there is a clear one?
Yeah, so this question of how do you figure out what the electorate's going to look like in advance is probably the biggest problem taken care of by pollsters. So I know this is what other similar forecast models do too, but for the most part, pollsters figure that out themselves by including what's called a likely voter screen. When they conduct the survey, they'll ask people, did you vote in the last election? How enthusiastic are you to vote in this election? And they have certain criteria. And they'll call someone a likely voter if they meet certain criteria. So for the most part, the pollsters themselves in the aggregate kind of figure out what the likely voter population is going to look like. There might be one early hunch I have. There was a moderately normal, but maybe slightly above average polling error this year. And there's some theories that the way these firms set up their likely voter models might not be capturing some right-leaning populations that are hard to reach. So that's one major challenge of polling these days. Because, for example, like people listening to this might say, like, well, I'm not going to answer my phone, because that's the way most of these surveys are conducted, is by phone, landline, or mobile phone. Well, I'm not going to answer my phone if I don't know the number.
Absolutely.
And are there certain demographics of people that are more likely to say something like that than others? Like, are you going to get non-response, like a non-response bias that favors one party or the other? So that's one question that I think will be litigated a lot in the aftermath of this election.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I know a lot of the people that I've talked to have kind of felt with this election and the past election, you know, with Hillary Clinton, it seemed based on the polls that she had a pretty favorable chance of winning. And with the polls this year, it seemed like Biden's chances were far more positive than they actually ended up being. And so I'm wondering, do you think that these two discrepancies in results as to what we would expect, are they due to mainly just the difficulties in sampling with polling and reaching more conservative-leaning rural populations? Or is this indicative of any larger flaw within the polling system itself?
That's a good question. So I'll start by kind of going over what happened in 2016. Most of the credible models had Hillary something like a 2 in 3 chance to win, 7 in 10 chance to win. So there was a moderate, fairly normal size, but moderate polling error in 2016. And in that case, it stemmed from the fact that prior to 2016, the level of education, whether or not you had a bachelor's degree, didn't really affect whether you voted for one party or the other. So in 2012 and 2008, for example, college educated and non-college educated people broke for the Democrat and Republican Party about evenly, or not significantly in favor of one or the other. And so pollsters prior to 2016 and in 2016 didn't account for any kind of discrepancy on that and make sure they didn't take major precautions to make sure they were getting an even number of college educated and non-college educated people in their samples. But what turned out to be the case in 2016 was that college educated people voted Democrat overwhelmingly and non-college educated people voted Republican overwhelmingly. So what you had was a major gap that wasn't accounted for by pollsters. So they basically weren't pollsters prior into the lead up to 2016 weren't getting enough people without bachelor's degrees in their samples. So they were totally missing this fairly substantial section of the electorate that favored Donald Trump. And that's basically the story.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So I guess I'm trying to tie this into 2020. I'll say in 2016, I think media coverage was not great in assessing uncertainty. It was probably, I wasn't as involved as I was this year, but it seems to me in retrospect that people were underestimating the chance that Donald Trump could win the Electoral College. So I guess I'll say a lot of those problems that pollsters had in 2016 were fixed in the aftermath. In 2018, the polls were quite accurate historically, like almost spot on in some cases. So going into 2020, a lot of us in the election forecasting community thought that these problems were fixed and that it was unlikely that a similar polling error would happen. At least in accordance to the education level.
Yeah.
And in addition, this year, Biden's lead in the polls was substantially more comfortable than Clinton's. So I guess I'll say the plus minus model had Biden at about a 9 in 10 chance to win going into Election Day. A lot of that stemmed from the fact that were you to apply a similar polling error in 2020 in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Biden would survive that and win somewhat narrowly and comfortably. And it seems that that's almost exactly what happened. So that's one reason. I think it's important when you go back and look at all these models. I know 538 also had about Biden had about a 9 in 10 chance to win, and similar for other places. It's important to recognize that that encompasses the 90% encompasses both a nail biter, which is not actually what we're getting, a somewhat solid, but not like overwhelming win, which I think is the area we'll end up being in. And it also encompasses things like a 413 electoral vote landslide where he wins Texas, where Biden wins Texas. So generally we've seen in 2016, like maybe a 3-point polling error, 2 to 3 this year, something similar. Although it was, I'll talk about this in a minute if you want, but it's hard to figure out what's going on with the polling error this year so far.
Okay. Well, if you want to expand upon that, of course.
So I talked about how the polling error in 2016, you could just say like, oh, it was education related. And so basically there was a 2 to 3 point uniform polling error across the country, some more pronounced and some less pronounced, but on average a couple points. And that was enough to cost Clinton those Rust Belt states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And I said also that it seemed to have been fixed in 2018. So this year, it's not clear yet what the cause of the polling error is. And also, it seems to be varying in magnitude basically across the country. I'll preface it by saying like not all the votes are counted. And I actually think there's like, it's not good to draw conclusions until all the votes are counted, and we're not gonna be able to like fully judge the polling error until all the votes are counted. But for example, like Biden looks like he's gonna win Wisconsin. All the votes are counted in Wisconsin. He's gonna win by about half a point. The polls had Biden up 7-8 points in Wisconsin, which is pretty massive. So that's probably on the bigger end of a polling error I've seen in the last two cycles. Also, though, in a state like Georgia, the polls had Biden up about a point, and he's looking to care as all the votes are trickling in there. It looks like he's going to win, barring a recount, by about a point or a little under. So
yeah,
in different regions of the country, we're getting like some areas where the polls were quite accurate and some where they weren't accurate. And it's not apparent at all that that's like solely due to one factor. And I would say it's probably due to many demographic factors or like sampling factors, just a lot of stuff left to unpack about this, which is not a great thing. Cause I think that in general, the media likes to like latch onto one particular story, but I think this is going to be require a lot of sophistication in how we talk about how we like assess the polls and how we assess like what happened in this election.
Before we end, is there anything else that you would like to say? Or
I'll close by saying, I said this earlier, but just wait until all the votes are counted to start drawing conclusions. I know that I'm kind of at a standstill right now trying to look at stuff. I'm telling myself not to like draw any sweeping conclusions about what we've seen so far. Like even the map changed so much from even Tuesday night to Saturday night that it's probably wiser to like wait to assess polling and don't assume based on what your emotions were on Tuesday night that the polls are going to be way off. It's looking like that's not going to be necessarily the case any more than it was in 2016. To conclude, I'll just say, like, just be patient while we wait for all the results to trickle in.
Well, that's all I have for today. Huge thanks to Tim White for doing this interview. Be sure to check out his model at plusminusforecast.com. Reporting for Radio K and the Real College Podcast, I'm Isaac Maruyama.
No matter who you voted for, election night was stressful for us all, as days later, the election has still not been officially decided. Luckily for me, my election night was more enjoyable than most, as I took the opportunity to tune out of the news and instead tune into the Imrika Election Night Comedy Special hosted by the Wiseman Art Museum.
And it came to pass that on the third day of November, in the never-ending year commonly called 2020, there was a comedy show. No, I don't mean the U.S. election. I mean a comedy show produced in association with the University of Minnesota's Wiseman Art Museum. A comedy show co-created by Minnesota's own Theater of Public Policy. A comedy show featuring Imrika.
Imrika, created in 2016 by Wata Bilal, is a New York-based comedy showcase that brings together a diverse group of comics from across the racial and religious spectrum, who all have one thing in common: they love to complain. As the show got on the road, the host, Tane Danger from the Theater of Public Policy here at the U, and one of the featured comics, Usama Siddiqui, gave viewers just tuning in a snapshot of how the election was shaping up early on.
100%. It's terrifying. It's right. You look at the map right now, it looks equal. I mean, I think Joe has 119, Donald Trump has 192. I'm refreshing until my arm goes numb. It's getting a little wild. Some of the swing states, it looks like Florida has a little edge. Georgia has a little edge. But if Florida goes blue, I think this whole nation explodes. There's no way that's going to happen, I don't think. But honestly, the fact that Texas is blue is still blowing my mind. So who knows what's going to happen, really.
Yeah, I got to say, I grew up in Florida. I grew up in South Florida. I just want to say on the front end, I apologize for the 2000 election. I will carry that with me forever.
I mean, listen, Ten, you got to apologize for Florida in general, too. Let's not go small. Let's macro that apology. Jesus.
It's true. But this is fascinating to me. So you think, Usama, that like Texas is more likely to vote for like a Democrat this year than Florida?
I mean, if you look at the map right now, that's what's kind of blowing my mind, is because right now, Biden has 50% and Trump has 48.7. So it's very close. I mean, it's very, very close. And that's 38 electoral votes right in the bag. And I'm from Texas, so I have no faith in my people. So I am blown away that all my bullies right now are going for Biden. It's blowing my mind.
One of the other featured comedians, Amr Zahir, went on to detail what the vibe was like where he was in Dearborn, Michigan.
No, people are nervous because I tell you, here you would expect that a lot of the vote would go to Biden, right? Because we're in a heavily Arab area. There's about 500,000 Arabs in Michigan, a couple hundred thousand at least registered voters. You know, we've seen a lot of Arab energy for Trump, not the majority, but more than what we thought. And I don't know. I mean, Trump sort of is like, you know, an Arab dictator, right? He gives his kids jobs that they're not qualified for. He lies about how much money he makes. He's like very, very many Arab uncles that I know. And he appeals this sort of, in a real way, this sort of machismo that comes out of the Republican Party anyway, I think appeals to a lot of minorities, actually, not just Arab Americans. So we'll see what happens. If Trump does better, you know, It seems like Trump is going to do not as good with white people as he did last time, but he might do better with some minorities. I mean, I'm looking at this stuff in Florida. He's up by 300,000 votes in Florida with almost everything counted. He's going to win Florida, it looks like. And I'm looking, he's up in North Carolina. He's close in North Carolina. He's up in Georgia big. So let's see. I mean, this could be a recipe. But by the way, let's be clear. I also went to law school a long time ago, and I teach law too. And there's going to be like a million lawsuits tomorrow morning. There's no way that we're going to really know what happens tonight. So we should prepare ourselves. I think this is going to make Florida in 2000 look like the It's a Small World After All ride at Disneyland. I mean, it's not going to be pleasant. This is going to be a... Are we allowed to say shit? This is going to be... Can we say that? Can I say...
Sure. I don't know. My parents are, but whatever. They can handle it.
Yeah, it's going to be a shit show. I mean, this is going to be a lot of people are going to learn a lot of stuff about American democracy that they're not going to be very happy about. We're going to learn a lot about how the sausage is made, and it's not going to be cute.
As the live stream audience began to grow, Tane asked Amr more about his background and plans for the future.
Amr, so you grew up in Michigan, you grew up in Pennsylvania, now you're in Michigan. Do you just like hop from swing state to swing state, and where are you moving next?
Yeah, I don't know, probably Ohio. And then Texas, as it gets bluer, I don't know. But I mean, I actually grew up in a swing country called Jordan, and I come from another swing country called Palestine. And then we moved here to America. And then I grew up in Pennsylvania, finished high school there in a very nice white neighborhood. Yeah, everybody was very nice. They were very nice and white. You know, they were all like, just nice white, like, you know, Episcopalian. Just really nice.
I'm from Minnesota. If you just replace that with Lutheran, you basically described a lot.
Yeah, you know, we had some Lutheran churches. It was, you know, all the different Protestants were hanging around us. And, you know, everyone was really nice. I thought I was white like the rest of them. I played baseball. I really didn't know I was different until I was running for class president in 1991. And then I put up photos of my face. And then that night, America bombed Iraq. And then someone wrote on my face, "Go home, terrorist." And I was like, oh, they do know I'm different. I had no idea. I guess they do know I'm not one of them. And that's when I joined Al Qaeda and started going to the meetings. And then, but I mean, on September 12th, I was like, you know, this is too much for me. I can't really hang out with these people anymore. But it was an interesting upbringing. So I decided to move from that ultra white place to Dearborn, Michigan, which is like all Arabs. And it has a beautiful history too. And I love walking around Dearborn because, you know, there are a lot of history. And every time I see an old church in Dearborn, I'm like, that is going to be a beautiful mosque one day. And so I just really love being here. And one day, hopefully, I'll come to the other sort of white mecca of Minnesota, where it's just a bunch of white people who are liberal, but they never have to prove it. I mean, what a nice place for white liberal people to live. So I hope to see you there one day, Tane.
Just before the first stand-up set of the night, performed by Susie Alfredi, Susie highlighted how difficult it was for her to vote, giving the others, especially Amr, a good laugh.
We registered 4 votes in Pennsylvania, and it was actually easier to get the mortgage than to register to vote in Pennsylvania because it was like a 3-step process.
To vote? What did you have to do to be able to vote?
First, you had to register, which was like something you do online. And then we had to get around the fact that we didn't have a Pennsylvania driver license. And then after registering, we had to apply for a mail-in ballot, and then we received the mail-in ballot, and then I had my in-laws who I had them sign. I'm like, here, sign here, and then I just sent the ballot.
Yeah.
I mean, but let's also be clear. Susie was trying to show up to register with, you know, her, a Palestinian with an accent, her Pakistani husband, in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. I mean, I would have double-checked all their paperwork. I would have made sure that they really were who they were. I mean, who are these brown people showing up in the Poconos? Have you been to the Poconos? Okay, it is like the Alabama of Pennsylvania. I grew up in Pennsylvania. It's the Alabama of Pennsylvania. And they're showing up. She's showing up with all this wavy, curly hair and a Pakistani husband and an accent and some weirdly mixed brown kids. I mean, I would have asked all kinds of questions.
It's so funny, Tane, because when I did the census, I consulted with Amr to fill out the form. And we are 4 people. And somehow we ended up with like 3 Pakistanis and 3 Palestinians. I don't know how.
I can imagine them going like, Susie, huh? Susie, right.
Right. How do you say your name in Muslim, Susie?
After their brief exchange, Susie then began her set.
I was out and about today and I sensed so much anxiety. I feel like, you know, we've all been studying for this exam and we submitted our exam and now we're just anxiously waiting for the results. I don't know, does anyone feel like that or am I the only nerd here?
Yeah.
And I also think that like Amir said, the result is not going to be in anytime soon. It's going to be a lot of mixed, confusing messages. It's going to be like when my son started school, like 2 months ago, we got so many confusing emails from his school that, you know, for the first day of school photo, you know how people post like really cute pictures of their kid, like wearing a collared shirt with like a chalkboard. And I like how she's translating what I'm saying. It's very cute. And the chalkboard says something like, first day of kindergarten. And so for my son, I had the chalkboard say, first day of no one knows what the fuck is going on.
After Susie's perfect set, the quartet began to talk politics, with Osama and Amr highlighting the widening disconnect between Republicans and Democrats.
I kind of want to go back to this piece that you were talking about, Osama, about that we're like very siloed. Like, we aren't talking to folks like outside of our own bubbles. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like I've heard people saying that for like 4 years or even like 6 or 8 years. And then I don't know if any of us actually do go and talk to people who are like outside our bubble.
We try to, and it's on Thanksgiving usually when the uncle says some things, and we're like, and we run away. We go back to our room. I think we need to stay at that table and have a conversation. That's the one time a year you get some exposure to anything right wing, even remotely. Sit your ass down, listen to Uncle Harry, sift through the N word a couple of times. It's fine. It's not fine, but he's, you know, we're, you know, there's also bad points in between those, Tane, as well.
Yeah.
So make sure you sit down, talk to these people, and not just discount them, because that kind of energy yields more anger than connection, and it creates very intense electoral maps.
I don't know, Amr. I'm wondering if, like, you're our like resident professor this evening. You are our educator in residence, and I'm wondering, like, do you feel like there's this gap? Like, we don't do a good job talking to each other?
I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is that we're all just too dumb. You know, America's the dumbest country in the world. You know, it's not me saying it. The UN does studies. And they find out that Americans rank last in everything, reading, writing, math. I mean, it's really, really a problem. That's why we wanted free college under the Bernie campaign. Like, we need to learn. We just get taught lies. I mean, you know, they tell us Columbus discovered America. He got lost, actually. He never even came to America. We have a game show in America. Let me tell you something. If you want to understand any society, you watch their game shows. And ever watched like a German or Japanese game show? Okay, it's the dumbest stuff you've ever seen in your life, because it's like adults walking through Jell-O and throwing eggs at each other, because a game show is an escape from reality. All right, that's, you live a serious life, you want to do stupid stuff when you get home or watch stupid stuff. But what are American game shows like? You know, pick a letter and spell a word, or you know, answer hard questions. Like, we think knowledge is amazing, so we have to give it millions of dollars. You know, like, our escape from reality is intelligence. Do you understand the problem? Okay, we have a game show in America, as you all know, called Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Okay, I'm sure you've all seen this game show. You go on this game show, you're an adult, by the way, you go on this game show and you answer questions from the first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. If you answer all the questions from the fifth grade correctly, do you know what you win? $1 million for answering questions from the fifth grade. $1 million. And guess what? Nobody wins.
After giving us all a thorough tongue lashing, Osama launched into his set.
All I'm saying, man, is that we're going crazy, Tane. Even the media is dumb as hell. Muslims still get anti-Muslim bias in the media. Muslim guy jaywalks. They're like, local Taliban leader. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, white dude shoots up a whole school. They're like, frequent soup kitchen volunteer. It's like, enough, Tane. You know, one time for Dylann Roof, they called him, I swear to God, they called him CNN, they called him a homegrown violent extremist. How are you going to make a terrorist sound like a Whole Foods item? Okay. Listen, Listen, he's homegrown, okay? Listen, he grew up in the same place he shot up, so he's also locally sourced, okay? So locally sourced. And you know what? The authorities have not caught him, so he's also cage-free. How about that, huh? Talk about it. Talk about it. I mean, he is 13, so he does have hormones, but, I mean, it's brutal. And you know, Tane, I'm from Texas, you know, and not I'm from Plano. It can get a little, you know, those Muslims who are a little too much. Sorry, the rednecks who are a little too much, who are like, you know what, I ain't wearing face masks. That's just a sideways hijab. All right? Nah. You know what? When the GPS tells me to go east, I go west. I ain't going to Mecca. And you know what? You know, I don't even eat cranberries no more. Because you can't say cranberries without first saying Quran. Okay? How to get you. All right? Eat a couple cranberries. Next thing you know, you're hijacking planes. All right? Not on my watch. Tane looks terrified. Listen, Palestine versus Pakistan. Are you going to be okay, Tane? Minnesota. The only minority you've seen is a Somalian. There's more out there, buddy. It's not just Somalians and white people, okay?
Oh, my God.
You're great, guys. You're great. My name really – it's Trump is wild. It's a wild situation, you know? And my name's Osama in a Trump environment, which is just hilarious already, you know? And no relation, obviously. My mom was terrified after 9/11. She was like, Osama, do you want to change your name to something a little less Muslim? And I swear to God, she said, how about Hussein? Very lateral move, mom. Okay? Hussein. I was thinking more Brian.
A special thanks to the Wiseman Art Museum and the Theater of Public Policy for providing the audio used in this story. If you are interested in viewing the Amrika comedy special in its entirety, you can do so on the WHAM's official YouTube page. No matter what happens, just remember to keep laughing. We're all in this together. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe. In our third segment of the 2020 election special, we will hear from producer Emma Morris as she explores the world of political advertising. Here is Emma with more.
I recently sat down with media law and ethics professor Christopher Terry of the Hubbard School of Journalism to discuss political advertising. It's everywhere, especially seeing as it is an election year. So what's the deal with it? My first question was about the course he is teaching this semester, a special topics execution course on political advertising where students are tracking the dollars spent on political ads. Why this course and what is it about, besides, well, political advertisements?
It is a 4,000 level school class in the Hubbard School. It's designed as a skills class, although it comes up as an execution class. I designed the class with another professor, Chris Eisen, in 2018 as a way to give students an opportunity to look at political advertising in real time. As a radio producer for Clear Channel and other places before I was a professor, I handled a lot of the documents that the political advertising business generates for television and radio. And it's a reality that the advertising industry is heavily influenced by the money that goes into political advertising today. And it seemed like a logical way to create a course that students could try to execute in real time, handling real documents to study and analyze political advertising patterns in the state of Minnesota.
My next question was about the trend of political advertising. What has changed and what's the big deal about it?
Well, political advertising has always been very important, and the rules that govern political advertising go back to the 1930s. But the reality is that after the Citizens United decision in 2010, you essentially not created, but certainly expanded a different line of political advertising, and that's the advertising by outside groups and political parties. And that's sort of the way political advertising has changed in the last 10 years. It's been 10 years since Citizens United, and we've certainly seen the effects of that now. But the reason political advertising is such a big deal now is because there is so much money involved in the process.
I then asked how this project was developed.
Well, for me, it was an opportunity to teach something I think is really, really important, and that's practical skills for students. Right. You can't have a strategic communication career and assume you're not going to have political clients. And that's just a simple reality because there is so much money. I mean, this election is going to be the most expensive yet. And they continue to get more and more expensive. It's just the volume of money here is just, it continues to expand. And there's little back from that. But how we do it is not, it's essentially very complicated. It's a practical skill. The Federal Communications Commission keeps a running database of all of the advertising that is bought and sold that deals with politics, either from a campaign or outside group. And that information used to be kept in a file cabinet when I handled it, but now it's available online through a central database. And what we did is we divided up all the television and radio stations in Minnesota, all the commercial television and radio stations in Minnesota. And we looked and collected all of that data. And then we entered it into a central database and analyzed it. And it's not, it's a really good practical skill, but it's not, it's more work than it is complicated work, so to speak. But what it then does is it gives the students their own set of political advertising data to do larger analysis projects for potentially portfolio items. And the real intent of the course is to give students an opportunity to do a real-time advertising campaign analysis and produce a project for that they can then include in their professional portfolios.
Finally, we close with discussing where this project could be found and any additional information on it.
There's one really important point that people don't understand about political advertising, and that there's really two kinds of political advertising. There's the advertising that comes from campaigns and official candidates. That advertising is very heavily regulated. Spending on it is, the way that advertising is run, the protections that exist for that advertising. Those are long-standing protections. They've been around for a very long time, and it is fairly heavily regulated. The other advertising, which is political-related advertising that comes from any source that is not an official campaign, is not regulated in any substantial way. And it's a little bit more Wild West. And that is the result of a couple of court decisions about 10 years ago now. And it's really sort of changed the metric for how political advertising occurs. But the reality is that this year, as it sits today, as we do this now, $13.61 was spent to influence voters of basically every man, woman, and child. $13.61 for every man, woman, and child in the state of Minnesota was spent since September 1st to influence voters in this election cycle. If you add up the advertising time that we've tracked, it's more than 1,274 hours of time at 30 seconds a spot, which is 53 full 24-hour days of back-to-back political advertising. That's how much advertising we're talking about. It is not a small number. And giving the students the opportunity to do this kind of work, it's not a small project, right? It is a project at scale done in real time on a week-to-week basis. And it's a great learning environment for the students. You could tell even this morning that many of them felt like they were taking something away from this. And we haven't even gotten to the analysis part. We're just on the data collection part so far. So it gives me a good feeling as a professor to know that I am providing that environment for students to do that. If people are interested in following Min AdWatch, we have a Twitter. It's MN AdWatch. On Twitter. We also have a website, but it is a WordPress site through the university. It's got a little bit longer address, but you can get there from the Twitter feed. There's a link on the Twitter feed if you want to join.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
Before this extra special episode of RCP draws to a close, we will hear from Trask Angel and Grant Sandberg in an extra special installment of Radio K Sports Hour. Take it away, guys.
Hello, everyone. I'm Grant Sandberg here on RCP, Real College Podcast. alongside with Trask Angel, we were able to track down and get an interview with someone to talk about sports and how that's related to voting in this election. And it's an interesting story for us. You know, it was difficult to find someone to interview with since voting is a difficult thing to talk about in elections and politics, but we're able to find an anonymous person who, you know, watches a lot of sports and they're not a big political person, not into voting per se, but they're able to vote now. And so it's interesting to get their perspective on all these sports leagues like the NBA and NFL who have started to have more voting emphasis on their leagues in terms of a lot of ads and even the NBA implementing polling stations inside their own stadiums, which has been a huge leap and really helped with the voter turnout in this past election. And so we were lucky enough to be able to interview this anonymous sports fan. And because he is anonymous, we have dubbed his voice, so it's going to sound a little different, but we still hope you enjoy. So here is the interview.
Hello, everybody. This is Trask Angel and Grant Sandberg talking with an anonymous sports fan for the voting episode of Real College Podcast. Welcome to the show. And just to start things off, did you go vote for this election?
I did. Yes, I did. I voted on Tuesday.
Okay, so you went out and voted. You are obviously an avid sports fan. Were there specific sport leagues or specific players that influenced your decision to go vote?
I think my plan all along is to go and vote. However, I think seeing that may have influenced other voters to come out, whether they're watching, you know, basketball or football. I think the issues related to this election cycle have been prominent and raised by players, which is always great. So I think just providing visibility to that in those different leagues definitely probably increased some of the turnout for this election cycle, but not me in particular.
And you're talking about sports like basketball, and I think something the NBA did that was interesting was not only did they have people talking about go out and vote, but they were actually able to turn their polling stations turn their stadiums into polling stations. And so do you think that also helped get young sports fans who aren't necessarily political out and vote more?
Yeah, absolutely. I think having more polling locations definitely helps, especially in urban areas, which a majority of the stadiums would be at. You know, just reducing lines and providing more locations to be in a safe COVID-free space is always great. So I definitely think having more polling locations, whether that's in a stadium or at a church or something like that, is always great.
So a lot of these leagues, a lot of these teams put in a lot of time, effort, and money into raising awareness about voting, turning stadiums into polling locations. Is that a trend that you think we'll see continue in the future? Or post-COVID, post-Donald Trump, we see that kind of awareness die down a little bit on the sports side of things? Or is that something that teams found success in this year and they'll continue to push that for future elections?
You know, I'm not too sure what the future is going to hold for that. I know personally, at least I hope it continues. I think, you know, being able to leverage the different platforms that we see in our everyday lives, at least for me as a sports fan, I think we should definitely continue that into the future. It's always going to come down to being a business decision for the different leagues, but it's definitely something I, as a fan, would like to see in the future.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much, sir, for talking with us and taking time out of your day. We really appreciate that. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for the 2020 election special. Stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.